Eric.
Hey, Charles.
How you doing?
We're doing good, man.
So you have a cool shirt on today.
Yes. Well, isn't it Earth Day soon? I don't know.
No, Earth Day's been over for a while.
Oh, really? Oh,
what kind of hippie are you, anyway?
Yeah, well, hippie without hair.
So we're in Building 99 again.
99 again. Hopefully another cool interview. We're meeting Cormac Hurley today, who is a researcher in the area of security.
Excellent.
I think this will be very interesting. So why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about, you know, your background and what you're doing.
Okay. I'm Cormac Hurley. I'm a researcher in security. It's one of the things I do. I've kind of historically worked a lot on data and signal-oriented things. And lately I've been sort of looking at, you know, economics and information security, which is kind of trying to figure out the incentives of why things go, you know, work the way they work, why things don't work the way we think they work, right? Because it seems increasingly clear that incentives have a lot to do with, you know, why you know a lot of cybercrime goes on, why it's hard to stamp out, why things are the way they are. So that's kind of what led to this, you know, the work we're going to talk about today.
Okay, so one of your recent papers is about, like, you know, if passwords make sense and if a lot of security measures don't cost more than what they prevent. So can you explain us a little bit about, you know, the economic background of security?
Sure. I guess I started with this, you know, this sort of paradox that a lot of people in security have wondered about, which is, you know, well, we keep telling users to do stuff, and like passwords are sort of the leading edge of it, which is, you know, use strong passwords. But there's also all sorts of other stuff, like, you know, look at the address bar, you know, pay attention to certificate errors, you know, don't you know, just click through pop-up warnings without looking. And you know, by and large, it's not speculation. It's been measured and kind of verified that people, by and large, just, you know, every password study that comes out says, you know, it's no better than it was 10 years ago, and with many, many other things. And I started to wonder about this, and like many people who do security, it's sort of, you know, well, what is it with these users? I mean, if only they understood the risks, why don't they? So I kind of started with that and said, well, let's see if we can come up with a better way of explaining to them exactly how important this is. And the more I thought about it, the more I began to understand. I'm having a lot of difficulty explaining because, you know, every security step that we ask of users, it has a benefit. Certainly it has a benefit. But it also has a cost to them, right? It's hassle or pain or difficulty memorizing something. And to persuade someone that they really need to do something, what you need to do is persuade them that the benefit to them is greater than the cost to them.
Yes, exactly.
And showing that that benefit is greater than the cost, this is something to be shown, not something to be asserted. And the problem with a lot of, you know, if you take, let's say, passwords in particular, you know, if you want to persuade someone that a particular course of action is really good, the best way to do it is to say, well, look at all the people who followed my advice, and look at all the people who did not follow my advice, and look how differently they fared. Look how... And the problem is, in security, we can't do that, because we don't have that data. And so this led me to the thought that, you know, well, this doesn't mean that it's not true. It doesn't mean that the benefit isn't really better than the cost. But it does mean it's not unreasonable for users to be reluctant when you can't show them the evidence, you can't show them the data. When it comes to things like, let's say, car safety, road safety people can show you the data that wearing seatbelts, you know, are really, really important, that, you know, not drinking and driving are really, really important. And when it comes to, just for example, password strength, we don't have the data to close the deal. That doesn't mean that it's not true, but it does mean that when users sort of, you know, shrug their shoulders, it's a little more understandable, right? We haven't given them a convincing case.
Yes.
And this is our failing, not their failing, right? If you really think it's super important, then get the evidence, make the case.
Yeah, but I would even say that even if you have evidence, a lot of users won't even, like, think, look at smoking, right? We all have evidence that smoking is bad,
right.
But still, you know, that's maybe a long-term thing, and people are more enticed by the short-term benefits.
No.
And maybe that's with passwords. You know, if you don't even have the kind of evidence that it works, you know, as a normal user, then, you know, I wouldn't be, you know, why would I do it at all?
No, right? Absolutely. I mean, I think there's, you know, the there are two slightly different things, which is one, you know, do I know and understand the risks? And second is, do I care enough? Right?
Yes.
There are some people who said their doctor explains to them about smoking and stuff like that, and said, well, you know, I just enjoy it. You know, your doctor, isn't empowered to, you know, go and lock you up and take away, you know, whatever it is he thinks is you shouldn't be doing. But, you know, when it comes to, you know, particularly, and I should emphasize that, you know, in this paper I'm really talking about the consumer space. I'm not talking about, you know, look, if your employer tells you to, you know, use strong passwords and change them four times a day, that's what you should do. But in the user and the consumer space, it's the user, the user's cost and the user's benefit and the user's decision. And, you know, we should do the best we can to make sure that they understand, look, here are the risks and here are the... And if we think that they're underestimating the risks, yeah, we want to make sure that they have a clear understanding. Or if we think that they're overestimating the cost, look, it's not as bad as you think to do these security steps. Yeah, we should try to do our best there. But when we really don't have, you know, the evidence, it's important to understand that this is, you know, this is our failing, not theirs.
Okay. And so do you have any, do you have concrete numbers, say, you know, this is like, you know, it costs, you know, users, you know, X amount of hours a year, you know, to deal with passwords, which means so many million dollars versus so many million dollars get lost because, you know, of fraud or...
So the password one, I mean, it's difficult to kind of, you know, quantify how much, you know, how much time it takes to choose a stronger password rather than a weaker password. We know that it costs people in the sense that when people have the choice between a strong one and a weak one, they always choose a weak one, right? You know, this seems to be the thing that we, you know, when it comes to the benefit, that is the harm that you evade by doing this. Mm-hmm. One thing that is, you know, maybe not as, you know, universally understood is that by and large, I think, you know, banks make people whole when they're phished or when they have, you know, money fraudulently taken out of their account. So it's what you're really losing when that happens to you is you're going to spend a whole bunch of time explaining to the bank that, you know, this wasn't first party fraud, that this was really something bad. So it's difficult to make the money mapping quite there. But one of the kind of good rules, I mean, one of the kind of, you know, approximations that I use is, you know, when you take something as large as the U.S. online population of 180, 200 million, something like that, mm-hmm. if you want an hour of user time, that's, you know, at twice the minimum wage, that's like $2.6 billion.
Yes.
If you have something where you expect users to spend a minute per day on it, that's like $16 billion a year. So when it comes to something like, looking at the address bar to try to figure out, is this website that I'm at, is it a real site or a hoax site? If you spend something like a minute per day on that, that would be, you know, you ought to be reducing the harm to users
yes.
by about $16 billion, or else it's not possible. That's a very crude approximation,
yes.
but it kind of gives a guide as to, you know, look, that the benefit is greater than the cost. This is something that has to be shown, and clearly we haven't convinced users of this. We know this because they ignore us. So.
Yeah. And so do you have any idea, like, what, say, how much money do we lose because of phishing? I mean, how much, you know,
so for phishing, Dene Florencio and I had a co-author. We had a paper a few years ago, and there were some other people at Cambridge who had estimates that kind of ran. Our estimate was about $60 million a year that was being lost by banks and... there were another estimate or two of 100 or maybe 200 million. So it's a lot of money. It's a lot of money.
Yes, but it's still a lot less than the billions you mentioned.
Exactly.
Plus,
exactly.
It's of course, it's yet to be proven that if you kind of, you know, pay attention to your URLs, how much you would reduce it, right, from that amount to...
No, I think you're just making a really good point, which is that I think one of the key things that fails to motivate users around security advice is that the promise of the advice is never security. It's not do this and be secure. It's not, okay, if I choose a strong password, then I'm safe. No, it's that I will reduce
an unknown risk
by an unknown amount,
yes.
which is, and that's, and I think that when it comes to, you know, passwords are, you know, the discussion of this paper is kind of largely, you know, kind of, you know, ended up on passwords because it's, you know, I guess, it hits all of us every day.
Yes.
There's a lot of us. But with strong passwords, you know, and don't get me wrong, strong passwords are better than weak passwords. But one thing that I think we can all agree on is if you've got a keylogger on your machine, it now no longer really matters
yes.
whether your password is strong or not, whether you reuse it across accounts or not, and how often you change it. It's So, I mean, it's quite difficult to kind of, I mean, this is one thing that I think we failed to do well, which is give people good tools to prioritize the advice that we give them, meaning that, look, yes, choosing a strong password is good, but keeping a keylogger off your machine is so much more important, yes. Right?
And so do you have any kind of numbers, like, you know, guesses, how many kind of machines have keyloggers? Is that known, or is that, again, is that a real kind of threat, or is that maybe some...
No, I think keyloggers are a real threat. I think that they are. And I think that, the data on this is a little fragmentary, but I think... it seems that, for example, brute forcing, which is, you know, brute force assaults on, you know, on particularly web passwords, are probably less a cause of break-in than phishing and keylogging, right? It's way easier to just get, you know, if you can get a keylogger,
yes, yeah.
I mean, why would I try to, you know, brute force your password if I can just get, you know, you to install a piece of code on your machine for me and I'll just collect them as they come in? That seems just way easier, way simpler, and way less visible. I don't have to worry about, you know, kind of, you know, the visibility of my attack on the backside. So we don't have good data. That's the problem. But I think it is very, you know, we need to put ourselves in the mindset of users, which is now this business of choosing a strong password. It's not that this makes me safe. Very far from it. What it does is it reduces my unknown risk by an unknown amount. For example, you know, let's say that 50% of credential thefts are due to keyloggers. Well, you know, if I happen to have a keylogger on my machine, all of the stuff that I do around passwords would now be kind of moved, right?
Yeah. So if we lift kind of the discussion a little bit to the more positive side,
sure.
So what kind of, you know, what would be alternative? I mean, when we talk to Butler Lampson,
yes.
Remember that he was talking about having a red and a green machine where, you know,
yep.
the red
yep.
machine, you know, you could wipe out all the time and your green machine you would keep super safe. Are there any kind of other alternatives for passwords or for this kind of protection that are, you know, more obviously, you know, working and, you know, cause less pain for the users?
That I wish I had the answer. As we were saying a little earlier, I mean, the, you know, passwords are a funny one, right? Where security people hate them, users hate them, and yet we seem to be stuck in this.
But they feel
this
to be something like, you know, like a kindergartner would kind of come up with, right? It's like, you know, let's have this secret word
right.
that you type in, and suddenly I let you into my domain.
Mm-hmm.
It feels so old-fashioned.
I don't have good answers for. I mean, you know, why we haven't managed to get to this. You know, there's so many really good proposals around, you know, token strong mm-hmm. two-factor schemes, and why haven't we got there? I mean, again, I think that's something where, you know, it's economics and incentives rather than, let's say, the crypto or security really reveals why we're stuck where we are, rather than moving into, like, one thing that I've started thinking about a little. I'm not sure, you know, that I have formed my thoughts are yet, but, you know, in Europe, for example, things are quite different, right? Many banks in Europe already use two-factor schemes, whereas in the U.S., it's almost unknown, right? I mean,
and so two-factor scheme is that when you kind of, you know, you have a little card with, like, numbers that you kind of have to type in every time where they say, you know,
yeah,
give
for example,
me the fifth number from your card?
Yeah, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, so something, you know, something that you know and something that you possess, and,
yes,
and
okay.
possession would be,
yeah.
you know, demonstrated by this time-varying
yes.
time-varying token. Something that can't be just keylogged once or captured once and then...
So that's also the reason why, like, fingerprints or iris scans don't work, because you could record them or keylog them as well? Is that...
I mean, I think that there are a number of... I mean, I'm not sure I can give a comprehensive answer on what, you know, whether
yeah.
biometrics will be the right answer and, you know, why we haven't got to this brave future already. I mean, you know, some of those things like biometrics sort of require rolling out hardware to lots of end users. So we have, you know, 1.5 billion, 2 billion people using the internet. And one of the nice things about passwords is that, you know, I can I can fly around the world and I can go and check my account, you know, with no expectation of what the hardware is, right? I can go to, you know, a machine running a strange operating system with a browser I've never seen before, and I get it, it works, you know, I mean, and bad things sometimes happen, but by and large it works. Whereas if you say, you know, to roll out some kind of a biometric scheme requires that hardware gets out with the ubiquity that, you know, that the internet currently now has, and that's tough. And okay. I think that's one of the things that slows it down, right? Is, you know, there are many things where we can look at a proposal and say, yes, this is clearly better than what we've got right now, but getting here, you know, getting there from here seems to be the problem.
Yeah. So another thing that's kind of, you know, related to passwords is, you know, what is it, a CAPTCHAs or what are they called? You know, these kind of weird things that you have to kind of type in, where I often feel that make me completely stupid because I don't even recognize what string there is. And then, of course, the computers do know it. And so that seems to me another thing where, you know, we're punishing humans for some kind of security.
No. I mean, and that's something that, and CAPTCHAs are, we are sort of, I mean, you're not the first person to remark that those are a little annoying. And I had a role in writing the audio CAPTCHA that's on the LiveID site. In defense, I would have to say that the alternative, if you take it away, is that, you know, it's just so easy for scripts to, you know, open accounts at will, right? You know, this is something where we put a little inconvenience in the way of users, but it actually does act as a significant block on having a script which opens, let's say, you know, we don't want someone opening 10 million Hotmail accounts a day just because they managed to write a script.
Yeah, but I would, in that case, I would expect maybe if you would kind of, you know, have something that would require some human intelligence instead of like pattern matching, right? If you would ask me a question, I don't know, what is the weather in Seattle today or something that...
You can just use Wolfram Alpha to answer it for you. It's so easy to break it.
That is true. I mean, that was like with the Channel 9 April 1st.
Yeah.
Although mine, he didn't get it.
Nobody got yours.
Does not know about the Jewish numerals, but yeah.
Which is odd, you know, and I sent them an email about that and haven't heard a reply yet. I think we have seven because of that.
But that's a good one. I don't know if you know, for April 1st on Channel 9, we had like, you know, you had to solve a puzzle to come in, and so Brian Beckman wrote this kind of, you know, weird formula that, like, if you look at it, my goodness, and the outcome was 9, but if you would type that into Wolfram Alpha, it would give you the answer immediately. So again, it's like, what does human intelligence mean, right? Machines are getting better and better.
And CAPTCHAs are, I mean, that's definitely, you know, it is something for which there is great need, but yeah, and keeping the balance between usability and security is a tough one. And I guess that's, you know, I'm by no means the only person who's sort of come to this conclusion, and, you know, there've been others who've said it, you know, earlier and perhaps better. But I mean, I think that's something that is, you know, that a lot of people are becoming, you know, increasingly on board with, which is that, you know, users are, you know, by and large, you know, the easiest way to exploit many security systems, but at the same time, just dumping an increasing burden of complexity on users isn't the solution, because, you know, if you give people 3 or 4 things to do, they maybe pay attention and do them, but when we give them, you know, 30, 40, 50, what tends to happen is they capitulate and then they neglect even the 3 or 4 that would have been the most important, right? Then they sort of do nothing. And I think that's something that we're, you know, we're aware of, because it's, you know, it's no longer possible to ignore the data coming in on this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we don't have definitive answers, but I think that this is something that there's a lot of people in the company looking at.
Okay, and you mentioned, so like we talked a little about passwords, but are there other things in your paper that you kind of, you know, looked at where, you know, this economic kind of, you know, disparity plays a role?
Yeah, I mean, so the other ones that I looked at, I mean, passwords obviously, you know, play a big role in all of our online lives. The others were certificate error warnings, where, you know, those annoying little things that say, you know, the site's website certificate has expired, you want to go through, and it used to be, I think, a one-click process, and now it's become, you know, in most of the browsers, a 3 or a 4 click process.
And most people don't even know what a certificate is.
And most people don't know what a certificate is. And further, you know, most people will have seen one of these certificate warnings in the course of their normal browsing, because, you know, certificates occasionally expire and people, you know, forget or they misinstall them. But pretty much 100% of the time that they've seen them, they've been false positive. Meaning, you know, your ordinary user, in the course of his browsing, has probably never seen one that was part of a genuine man-in-the-middle attack. Now, again, that doesn't mean that such an attack can't happen, but it does mean that it's easy to see why users don't see this as a useful tool to protect. If you have a warning technology, and 100% of the time that I've seen give me a warning, it's always been a false warning, then, you know, it's natural that I'm not going to pay a great deal of attention to it.
It's right? A little bit like the light in my car that kind of keeps saying, maintenance required,
yes.
And then every time I go, you know, it says, oh, you know, there's something wrong, we'll reset it.
Exactly. So, you know, a warning, you know, people have to have faith that the warning actually means something significant to them. And that sort of requires, I guess, that you know, it doesn't you know, go off all of the time and just distract them for no real significant reason.
So again, if I take the discussion to a slightly higher level and reflect on this, it's like, you know, so at some point somebody must have decided that it was a good idea to give a warning for these certificates, and I'm assuming that they don't do that just to, you know, annoy us. Mm-hmm. So, but it does kind of, you know, raise the question at me, is that do we do these things, like, you know, certificate warnings or passwords, because that's the easiest thing to do, but we're not really trying to make users secure, but this is like something we say, oh, you know, this is technically feasible, so let's pop up a warning.
I don't want, you know, the people who are responsible for the certificate warnings in the browser, I know some, I mean, you know, they're doing really...
I don't want to take it personally, but just kind of, you know, in the abstract, right?
And, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the main thing that I was trying to get to in this piece of work, and the thing that was a real, you know, eye-opener for me was, you know, it's hard for those of us who know something about security and who know what can go wrong and who know how kind of ingenious and creative the bad guys out there are. When we see an exploit, and we see a way of patching it or drawing attention to it, it's clear to us that this has benefit, right? Here's a possible exploitation, and closing it off has benefit. The thing that is... the fact that this also imposes a cost on user, we know that, but it's always been sort of, it's a harder thing to measure, right? You know, for example, certificate warnings. How many people see certificate mm-hmm. warnings every day as they're browsing? Well, we don't have actually a good answer on that, and how much pain does that really cost? Well, I don't know if you can really put a dollar number on it, but it's something that people find annoying, but it's also something that when you accumulate enough of them, causes people to, you know, start to click through certificate warnings, but also click through other kinds of warnings.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
People's pop-up experiences become a little too rich, and they no longer pay attention to that stuff. So I think the meta point is that, you know, look, you know, all of the security advice that I've pretty much seen, right? You know, I haven't seen anything where I'd say, no, this is really truly bad, right? This is, but they all have benefit and they all have cost, and that the benefit is greater than the cost. This is something that really has to be shown and examined and thought about quite hard. Because when we get that wrong, you know, first of all, when we get it wrong, people just ignore it. But two, I mean, we've gotten to the situation where things are very, very complex, and it seems like the complexity is just growing, right? You know, people's online experience mm-hmm. are not getting simpler. So we have to prioritize, right? We tell people, you know, here's you know, security advice that'll help you stay secure, and it would be great if everyone did all of it, but we know that they don't. So, for example, what I was talking about earlier, keeping a keylogger off your machine is more important, I think, than actually having any individual one of your passwords strong. So, it would just be tragic if, in giving people lots of advice, they don't know which ones are important and which ones are unimportant, and they say, well, I can't do all of it, so they they choose, you know, one or two that they end up doing and choose the wrong one.
Yeah.
So for example, you know, doing your automatic updates and, you know, all of the things that you can do one time and get ongoing goodness out of, those are things that you should not neglect, right? Doing your backups mm-hmm. is something you should not neglect. Running an antivirus is probably something you should not neglect. Where, you know, it'd be really, really sad if you neglected to do those things because you're trying to figure out what certificates are, you're trying to parse, you know, URLs, and, you know, you fall for something really, really bad, and it just negates and undercuts all of the the other stuff that you're doing.
So another place where a similar thing happens is in programming itself, right? If you and there, I think that was just kind of, I think they show it yearly. I forgot the things like this is a list of all the kind of, you know, security programming mistakes, you know, you should avoid. You know, again, it's like, you know, like, you know, many, many pages of things. And if you look at your own code, you go, oh my goodness, you know, it's like I cannot write a single line of code and it's full of security errors. Do you believe that there's also that same effect where, you know, you can make it, try to make it super secure, but maybe, you know, the cost, you know, is more than the benefits, or maybe, you know, you introduce other bugs because you're trying to make it secure?
I think, you know, when it comes to, you know, when it comes to, you know, programming and when it comes to protocols and when it comes to systems, right, you know, I mean, you know, what I'm saying here could be, you know, could be misunderstood, right, you know, like, we can't allow exploits in our software. We can't allow you know, drive-by downloads happening in the browser. Right? Those are things where you know we have to absolutely keep ourselves to the absolute higher standards. The when it comes to costs that are imposed on users, right? And again, I'm talking about, you know, consumers where it's their own costs and their own benefits. They're not risking their employer's, you know, secrets or their employer's stuff. You know, there, it's, you know, unless we give people some prioritization, right? You know, it's just like if I think of, say, you know, kind of older people who are less familiar with computers, but they use email and Facebook because that's where their grandkids are, right? It's not realistic to expect that they're going to do all of the stuff that you and I can pay attention to, right? You and I can do it because, well, one, it's easy for us. We understand how these things work. And we do it for a living. So we have to be able to prioritize based on these are the most important things. And that's I think I think that's the thing where we have the greatest opportunity for improvement. Is that when we're talking with end users saying, you know, look, here's 40 things that you should be doing, but you know, here's the 3, 4, or 5 that are just supremely important. Whatever you do, don't neglect these.
Okay, but just to go back to our kind of our own world of programming, because my feeling is that we're often trying to be kind of a little bit black and white or binary, because if you look at the real world, I mean, let's take the building that we're in now, I mean, it's designed to be safe, but still probably there's like, you know, if there's an earthquake, it should withstand an earthquake, but not if the earthquake is like, I don't know, too heavy or something. So it's not an absolute safe building, right? So there are certain margins, and shouldn't we have something like with our programs too, where you know you can never make it completely secure, but so having some notion of where you can say, you know, this is secure kind of, you know, within these margins, or
there has been a you know, whole bunch of stuff in other areas of risk analysis, like say things like road safety. When they construct bridges, they say, well,
exactly,
you know how much is a human life worth? Well, you know, when we build bridges, we make them to stand up to some kind of an earthquake, and we're saying we're not going to pay twice that. And effectively, we're putting, you know, costs on life. I think one of the things that's a little you know, different in software is that, you know, it's very hard for us to figure out when a bug leads to a kind of a systemizable, scriptable attack that, you know, if there's a small error somewhere in a program as widely deployed as IE, you know, that can easily end up being just an enormous deal. I mean, I fully agree with what you're saying. Like, we need to sort of measure what is the potential impact of this thing. What is the potential, you know, if you look at security as binary, as, you know, it's either secure or it's not secure. Well, you know, that's kind of galaxies away from the world in which businesses live and make trade-offs.
Exactly, and the real world, right? The real world is not like that.
But the But when you come to software that's kind of as widely deployed as things like, you know, our operating system and our browser, I think it gets harder to do that. You know, we almost have to be binary in the analysis because, because the potential harm is truly tremendous. Even tiny things, when you factor it into the hundreds of millions of people using the browser, it's just gigantic. I think that's we got to be careful on that.
Yes. And also, I think that's something that, you know, what also is kind of different than the real world is that, you know, a little exploit, you know, you can write another program that, you know, leverages that exploit.
Right.
So, you know, it's kind of easier to automate the bad guys, whereas, you know...
Right, and something that looked like, something that looked like a small error or not so big a deal, if that ends up being kind of leveraged, and suddenly you have, you know, a backdoor that allows, drive-by downloads on IE, that is a huge deal, right? You know, you could, if it's bad enough, have, you know, keyloggers on every machine that's simply just a risk that is intolerable, right? That's where it kind of, the unpredictability of that leverage just means that binary thinking maybe there is kind of, it's more understandable.
Yeah.
I mean, what I'm saying about about users is that it is less binary, meaning that, you know, when we're coming to pushing a cost into, you know, if you're talking about 200 million online users in the US, when you ask them to do something, if you say, hey, it'll only take a minute a day, well, a minute a day for 200 million people, that's a lot. It had better be eliminating something pretty big, you know, not just something that we think, you know, could happen. It should be something that, you know, is pretty big and pretty serious.
Although it's also kind of, you know, interesting or maybe mind-blowing, because suppose that we're saying, you know, okay, you know, you don't have to do strong passwords. Now maybe the bad guys might say, oh, you know, there's now this advice that, and so they, that kind of, you know, leads to another. So it's like a completely non-linear, chaotic system where you cannot predict what, you know, if you give this advice, what will happen, you know.
No, you do have, I mean, you know, that's a very reasonable point. I mean, and again, you know, let me re-stress that, you know, you know, much of what I was saying is that, you know, first of all, I'm not giving anyone advice. Well, all I'm really, you know, saying is that when you look at our failure to produce a convincing argument backed with evidence, this doesn't mean that the conclusion is, you know, that the, you know, some of these things are not important. It merely means that it's understandable that users behave as they do because they've just got a lot of stuff to do. But, you know, you're absolutely correct, is that, and this I think is one of the you know, the things that make security very complicated, which is that, you know, we're dealing with an adaptive opponent who we sort of assume knows our strategy and adapts accordingly. But and that's true. I mean, reactive security is kind of is risky. But I think that when it comes to pushing stuff to 200 million users, that actually may be the best that we can do. I mean, if we have to adapt the advice that we give to users on, you know, a weekly, monthly, or even yearly basis, we're in big trouble anyway, because, you know, rolling anything, any piece of information or advice and expecting adoption is very, very, very difficult. So I think, yeah, I'm certainly not advocating use, you know, it's okay to use kind of weak passwords. But I think if you look at, you know, if you look at, say, some of the, you know, some of the really, you know, big e-commerce and even banking sites, right? Some of them show, you know, a lot of, you know, the passwords are not as strong as you actually might imagine. They don't impose, you know, including, say, Fidelity, which, you know, handles our 401k and stuff. They're not one of those, you know, websites that says you have to have 12 characters with, you know, they have very large assets, and they have, you know, they show some, they figured that they can manage the risk, right? This is something that they figure out how to make it work. I'm not saying that, hey, you know, four-digit PINs are fine. I'm saying that, you know, if you look at, you know, really very large, well-attacked, you know, sites, I mean, that make it work, that might be where the sweet spot is.
So, and another thing to kind of, you know, to tie it back also into the real world, if you look at, like, you know, if you protect your house, you know, you put locks and whatever, but still, you know, somebody might break into your house. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we have, like, a legal system, right? We're kind of chasing the kind of bad guys and put them in jail. Should we also, for, like, cybercrime, have a more, you know, have more also kind of, you know, a stronger legal thing where, you know, you turn it, instead of kind of putting the burden on the user to keep their things safe, well, of course, you know, that's in the real world too, but then have also, you know, cyber police or more, you know, legal action where, you know, people get punished when they do cybercrime.
No, this is a very interesting area, and, you know, I think it's you know, I mean, it's an area where, you know, there's technology, there's policy, there's law enforcement, there's, you know, there's just a huge sort of, you know, confluence of things, and I think we're really just struggling to catch up here. I mean, so there are you know, the answer is it's hard, right? A lot of this stuff flows across jurisdictions.
Yes,
a lot
yeah.
of this stuff is it's very, very difficult to trace. So it's kind of very, I mean, it's very interesting in that, you know, never before have you had, yeah, you can be sitting, you know, you can be sitting happily, you know, in your house in Redmond, and you could be, you know, very close to the clutches of a, you know, I don't like to pick nationalities, but, you know, a Russian or a Ukrainian gang, or, you know, which is not a situation that we're normally, you know,
yes.
It's almost unique, it's almost the first time in history that this kind of thing has happened, and I think we're really struggling to catch up. We're really, because, you know, a lot of this stuff is very difficult to track down.
Yes, yeah, but in some sense, like, somebody putting a keylogger on your machine is like, you know, it's violating, you know.
No, absolutely.
Yes, so it's like, you know, breaking into your house, it's even worse. And
right, no, yeah. Absolutely, and then some, I mean, in some ways, right, I mean, you know, like, a lot of the, you know, when it comes to passwords and banks and things like that, you know, it's money, but, you know, money is you know, I think one thing that that maybe we haven't worried about enough yet, and is kind of maybe even a bigger deal, when we start putting things like health records online,
yes,
there are some things
yes.
where, look, I mean, if somebody steals your money and we figure it out, we can insure against this, or we can, you know, I'm not minimizing it, but this is something that is reversible to some degree, whereas there are other things where the invasion of privacy and the kind of the sense of violation can be, it's not possible to reverse, and it's just very, very, very great. I think, yeah, we're in a brave new world here. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Good. And so we talked about passwords and, you know, the certificates. Are there any other things?
Sure. I guess the one other kind of thing that I sort of, you know, talked about a bit in this paper was the, you know, trying to educate users on whether they're at a good website or a bad website,
yes,
by looking
okay.
at the address bar. And I think, you know, that's something that comes, you know, very naturally to people like you and me, but that's...
Although, you know, the scary thing is the more you know about it,
the more you know that, the less you know, right?
Exactly,
I mean,
yes. And maybe Unicode was not such a good idea. Maybe we should have stayed with just, like, you know, the old, good old ASCII characters.
But I guess, you know, many of us reflexively look at the address bar to kind of, you know, see what am I doing. When I get an email from somebody, I look at the, I know that there's a difference between, you know, hotmail.com and, say, you know, microsoft.com. But when it comes to the address bars, I mean, you're right that even those of us who think that we know what we're doing can, you know, never be 100% certain. But when it comes to ordinary users, I mean, what's in that address bar is, you know, it's amazing how much of your knowledge and your understanding of how DNS works and how the internet works to be able to figure out, yeah, this is the top level domain, this is the second level domain, that this is the host, that hosts are parsed, you know, in this direction, the path is parsed in that direction, this is what the S means,
yes,
this is what, and, you know, that www.paypal.com and www.paypal.com.evil.com are, you know, two completely
yeah.
different things. This is just a lot of stuff to explain to someone who doesn't really, you know, do this stuff as part of their job. And further, I think the thing that really makes it a very difficult approach is that, you know, it's very difficult, you know, we can give people rules of thumb and heuristics on, well, sometimes if you see this, it's bad. But that's not really what they want. What they want is, well, tell me how to figure out if it's good, right? And,
yes,
and a
yes.
rule that and a rule that tells me, well, if you see this, it might mean that it's bad or it might not. This really is a way of consuming time, but really not giving me what I crave, which is, I just want to know that it's good. I just want to know that I'm safe. What do I do? And I think that this is one of the things that we really have to, you know, work a lot harder at, is because, you know, I mean, I think a lot of computer security people are good at saying, you know, like, blame the user is a favorite game, right? You know, as well.
Yes, yeah.
You know, and blame the user is ultimately fruitless, right? It's not, you know, it's not their fault. And no one, I can't remember who said this, but, you know, no one bought the computer so they could install an antivirus, right? You know, they're just doing their stuff.
Yes, yeah.
They're just doing their stuff. And if they don't... And I don't think there's any shortage of, you know, I know, you know, many of my friends who, you know, who aren't really, you know, necessarily super technical, and they often ask, okay, what should I do to keep myself safe? And I don't think that they're lazy. If I could give them, here's the five things you do.
Yes,
you
sir.
Do this and then you're safe. I think they would actually do them. And,
huh.
You know, I don't think I have that list. I don't think I'm the guy to lead us out the way, you know, out of this wilderness and articulate those. But I think that that's the way we need to be thinking. We need to, you know, recognize the mindset is that, you know, they're not necessarily lazy. They, when we give them, you know, if you give them five things to do, there's a good chance that they'll do it. Some, okay, still won't do it. But if you give them 40, the probability is that they won't do any. And they certainly, you know, they won't do the most important ones. And that's really where we need to get better at, you know, refining the message, make it really... you know, really simple for them.
Yeah, but also I think it's also like, you know, the world of the computer is also very abstract, right? Because if you have a kid, you can say, be careful of the stove, and the kid of course ignore you and then hit the stove, you know, it's hot. But with you know, with computers, it's very abstract, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's far removed, but you know, you cannot relate it to something physical often.
And I think that, I mean, one of the things, you know, I think those of us who do it, you know, who do it every day, who do it for a living, I mean, it is abstract, but we've grown so, you know, so familiar and so comfortable with it, we don't, it's hard for us to get back into the mindset for how little sense a lot of this stuff makes to regular
yes.
people. Like, 'cause you and I are used to, when something goes wrong with my PC or a friend's PC, you know, we just go and we sit down and we check this,
yes,
check
yep.
that, check that. And one of the things I notice about the people, you know, that I'm friendly with who don't, they're very reluctant to experiment. And they have this fear that, well, I'm afraid I'll break it if I do. They don't have this, you know, model in their head of
yes.
how it works the way that we
and
do.
And they shouldn't, really.
And they shouldn't. But I think that this was one of the insights for me in doing this work. I think it was kind of a humbling experience in the sense that, you know, as I keep saying, right, you know, that we must show that the benefit is greater than the cost. But I think in many cases those of us who do this stuff for a living underestimate the cost, because when I talk about looking at the address, what are you talking about? It's no big deal. I mean, I just know that this is the way it works. Whereas for someone who's unfamiliar with this stuff, this would be, you know, probably weeks of training to figure out how to do this, and then, you know, a minute or so of effort, you know, several times a day.
But one thing I would say about that is that doesn't solve the problem of the future, which is no address bars at all. So if I'm using a
mm-hmm.
handheld device
mm-hmm.
to access my bank, I might be using an app I downloaded. There is no URL. There's
yes,
a button
or even
address.
If you have this kind of minimized URLs, right, where you have
yep.
this, like, you know, that you cannot even
yep.
you know see what it is. Yeah,
right. It's, you know, absolutely. And we kind of, there are many things. I guess there are many things on the internet where we're sort of, you know, that get used in a way far away from the way they were ultimately designed.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, using the address bar as a security indicator is definitely one of them, right?
Sure.
Is definitely one of them. Because just that context, right? I mean, even explaining to people, this is one thing that there was a user study done, I can't remember by who, but I mean, the fact that when users look at a browser, it's instinctive to you and I that, you know, well, the pixels at the top of the browser and are different from the ones down here, right? You know, that this is the application and this is the content. This is not as naturally understood by everybody as we might imagine. You know, it's I think we have to work really hard at you know, putting ourselves in the mindset. So I think, you know, but you know, on the positive, I don't want to kind of sound like this is all you know, it's all hopeless what to do. You know, it's you know, I think, I mean, we are figuring out you know, that, you know, that this is a, you know, a serious problem, and we're getting much better at, you know, doing user studies, doing measurements, and instead of, you know, speculating on what people will or will not get, we're actually putting it in front of them and measuring what happens. And sometimes it comes up with bad surprises, and, you know, well, and when that happens, we go and fix it. That's what we do, right?
And also I think that maybe we should go even further and look at, like, say, health education or something. I mean, I just watched, like, a series, a PBS series about, like, you know, global health and, you know, like things like polio or something, where even, you know, when people see that, you know, it leads to, you know, disaster, you know, they're very reluctant to get vaccinated and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, you know, even if people know that there's a danger and they know the cost, they might still be reluctant to, you know, to protect themselves.
Yeah, I mean, the you know, I you know, well, speculating on what people will and will not do.
Yeah,
but
in the end, isn't it all just like a human thing? It's a psychology.
But I think that, you know, I think that there's good reasons for optimism when you give people, you know, when there's something that they really care about, and you give them a way of addressing it that takes care of it. I think that they respond. I mean, if there's something that, you know, where, like a very good example, is there was this, you know, waterborne illnesses kill about, you know, 1.8 million people, you know, a year, and it's mostly cholera and dysentery and stuff like in developing countries. And there was this team about, you know, 7-8 years ago who figured out that they did the study in Bangladesh, where having women filter water through folded saris blocked out much of the cholera stuff. Now, it didn't make it go away. I mean, it reduced by something like 90%.
Yeah, I heard a similar story about in panties or something, yeah, for some, like, bug. Yeah.
But the point is that the compliance rate, they went and taught this, you know, technique to Bangladeshi, you know, women in villages, and the compliance rate was almost 100%, right? When you gave them away, you know, they knew what was killing their kids, right? Telling them to boil water for 20 minutes is sort of infeasible. It's very good advice, but it's just, you know, has no problem, you know, impact on the problem that's manifested. But when you give them something, what a problem where they definitely care about, you give them a tool that is within their means to address it, and it doesn't make it perfect. I wouldn't want to drink that water, but this is the best that they can do.
Yeah.
That you get such good compliance, is that's encouraging, right? You know, when we identify the things that have the biggest impact, you know, on what users really care about, I think you know, there are good reasons for optimism.
Good.
Well, let's.
I think this is a nice place to end.
Nice
place,
yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Nice happy.
Yes, a nice happy ending. Unless Charles.
No, because I was going to take it down a dark rabbit hole.
Okay. Well, no.